You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get a ringside seat to the world of professional wrestling from one Wisconsinite who made a career he loved out of making wrestling stars look good. First, there's a new report that makes it clear, and I quote, the extent to which racial inequality is a defining feature of Wisconsin. The report is called Race in the Heartland, and it brought together organizations from multiple states. The Center on Wisconsin Strategy compiled Wisconsin-specific data from the larger report. And to tell us more about how Wisconsin fits into this larger picture and what can be done about it is Laura Dresser. She's Associate Director of COWS for short. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What do you find most striking about this report on racial disparity?
I mean, I think anybody paying attention to racial disparity in this state knows it's extreme and knows it's a real concern, though I think we don't pay enough attention to how extreme it is. I think the two things that are really revelatory to me is one is that we finally kind of anchor Wisconsin's reality inside the Midwestern context. And the story of race in the Midwest is really a story of migration, manufacturing opportunity, segregation, and growing disparity. I think people think of the roots of racial inequality in the South because of this of slavery there. But this is about the roots of racial inequality in the Midwest.
And where does Wisconsin fit in with our neighbors? Are we the same? Are we different?
We're sometimes the same and sometimes sometimes different. I think there's a couple of things that are true of the Midwest. The Midwest has a lot of large urban centers that got decimated by manufacturing job loss. Think of Detroit. Think of Ohio. Think of Milwaukee. And that's a story where the opportunity drew migrants that generated a black middle class off of strong manufacturing union jobs, that as those jobs went away and as those places became isolated and the racism and segregation set into those geographies, black workers became more and more isolated from opportunity and gaps opened up that way. So that story is all across the Midwest, and we have that in Wisconsin. But also there's the story of the best places to live kind of cities. And that's here too, Des Moines, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Madison. And even in these places, we have extreme racial disparity. So both things are going on. And I think that's kind of part of the story here.
And sometimes today that shows up in something like infant mortality.
Yeah. For example, Wisconsin's rate of black infant mortality is the worst in the nation. Our disparity between whites and blacks is fourth worst in the nation. And that's really shocking. A black baby has three times the chance of dying as a white baby in this state. And so from the very birth, right, we have this disparity in even your chances of living.
Right. We think that, if we can just change, if we can be better to one another, then everybody would have equal chance and that would be enough. And what the numbers show is that, no, from birth, that's the answer.
From birth, we're seeing a disparity like, you know, if you and we kind of try to walk through the life cycle here. So we looked at birth, like at birth, greater chances of dying in the schools. Greater disparity in outcomes, worst in the nation on third grade reading tests. In child poverty, very large disparities between the black population and the white population. One way I think about this is that in the state of Wisconsin, we have systems that are strong and work pretty well for our majority population, for the white people who have been here. The systems that were set up worked pretty well for them. We set up systems that were very segregated, and that had very hard walls for access, very hard racism sort of structured into this economy as well. And so the same systems generate this disparity, don't work as well for the black population.
Laura Dresser is Associate Director of COWS, formerly known as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. She's also an Assistant Clinical Professor in the UW-Madison School of Social Work. Want to address any concerns about the integrity of the Race in the Heartland study? How do we know that this is good data we're drawing from?
Well, so this is every single source is a nationally, federally offered sample, the Centers for Disease Control on mortality, the American Community Survey and census sources. And consistently what we're doing is looking at white medians and black medians and the disparity between the two. And so sometimes that's a different way of looking at what opportunity looks like than the absolute levels. But it's almost, every single source is a national or kind of reputable source. If you went to this data, you'd find the same thing.
Great. That helps us understand, you know, how much to believe, because we always wonder about cherry-picked samples, and that's not the case with the numbers we're dealing with now.
And I think partly what you can see is the consistency of this. If you go to almost any piece of data, whether it's educational data or income data or incarceration data, you get the same picture. Wisconsin is the most desperate or close to.
So if we're not going to be able to solve this at the individual level, we have to deal with policy, right? There are so many policy suggestions that are laid out in this report. But, you know, what can we deal with when it comes to voter participation? I mean, Wisconsin is third worst disparity-wise in the nation for voter participation.
Yeah. I mean, think about that for a little bit. You know, the white population in the state is pretty likely to vote by national standards, but twice as likely to vote as the black population in the state. It just means there's greater representation of the interests of that population. There's fantastic work going on, I think, in Milwaukee, where black leaders organizing. Block is a mobilization and a community organizing campaign to generate black voice in democracy. I think we'll see a lot of, and you see Voces de la Frontera really mobilizing the Latino community. So different voices trying to bring more attention to the diversity of the state into the political process. And that's exciting. But we see policy decisions that are actually making it harder for people with less money, less access to vote. So the voter ID really hits students, people without IDs, people without, people without cars and no need for driver's license. So you can see both community mobilization around securing the right to vote and some state policies that really push against it. And I think in almost any of these categories, you can kind of see that tension, some focus on increasing equality and some like where our state policies are actually pushing towards greater inequality.
What about this concept of saving places, implementing policies that improve neighborhoods?
Yeah, I think one thing to think about is that the story of race in Wisconsin is geographically rooted in many ways. And we need to pay attention, especially to Milwaukee and how the public institutions in Milwaukee work. We've paid attention some to public schools in Milwaukee, but we haven't invested in them so much as we've like created a kind of competition between on the school choice system there.
Right. Trying to get into the better schools.
Yeah. So that there's
not
more
all
chaos
better, right.
Instead of really investing in all the schools and making that system work. But I also happen to know data from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and the access and graduation rates of people of color at that institution are not what they need to be to generate college degrees in our population of black and brown people. And so there's that's a question of, you know, investing in a place, Milwaukee, because it is the center and heart of the diversity of this state. And that's where solutions to the inequality partly need to get written.
And how do you push back on the idea then that, though, well, then we're dedicating so much effort in Milwaukee when we have an entire state, when we have people all over the place?
Right. I think we need to see more investment, in fact, in public infrastructure all over the state. But if we want to close these gaps, if we want to make our state work as well for people of color in the state, black people in the state, as it does for white people in the state, then we have to be attentive to not only universal policies that would impact everyone, like raising the minimum wage or extending union rights, right? We have to look at specific policies that help decrease the racism in the state, that generate access and advancement opportunities for people of color in the state, and that focus on specific places too, because that's how the gap will close.
Laura, thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Dresser, Associate Director of COWS, talking to her today about a new report on race in the Heartland and Wisconsin's extreme racial disparity. Our next guest has suffered broken hands, cracked ribs, he's dislocated knees, he's had concussions. He's wrestled stars like Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, and even a 600-pound black bear. And it's all because of his passion for the sport. If you have questions for a former pro wrestler, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Your chance to get some answers. What have you always wondered about the sport? Maybe you were a fan from back in the day. Maybe you like it better now. 800-642-1234. Chris Mulderer is our guest. He is known in the wrestling world as Chris Curtis, wrestled professionally for more than 20 years starting in 1978, grew up in Wisconsin and worked for organizations including the American Wrestling Association and also the World Wrestling Federation. And his book is called Job Man, My Life in Professional Wrestling. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much, Keely, for having me. This is a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, we could go a lot of places, but man, we got to start with the bear. You wrestled a bear.
I actually did, and I wrestled, his name was Victor the Bear. This was at the sports show in Milwaukee back in 78. And this was actually before I got into wrestling. And I was either going to do a little show like a Bobby Heenan and put on a show and goof around, or I was really going to attempt to beat the bear. I chose to beat the bear. I was scared to death because I didn't know what I was expecting. And then what I did was I went in and I double-legged him and I got him on his back. And when I got him on his back, I hooked his arms, you know, his front legs, and he couldn't get up. And I was at the Milwaukee Auditorium. The building was packed. It had 6,000 people, and it was probably one of the greatest moments ever. 3 months later, I wrestled another bear. It was like terrible Teddy or something. Well, Teddy was about 7 feet tall and weighed 650 pounds, and he was a brown bear, and I wrestled him twice. First time, it was kind of a draw. The second day, I went back, and I tried it again, and he beat me up pretty good. He tore my rotator cuff slightly, and that was pretty much it for wrestling bears.
For wrestling bears, but not for wrestling in general, right? I mean, I understand your love of wrestling began when you were just a young kid, and you know, you made it into the ring. What really drew you when you were little to the concept of wrestling?
Well, it was all on accident. I was playing outside with one of my brothers. We were playing catch with a rubber ball, and I threw the ball. He ducked, and it bounced off my sister's head. I'm 9 years old at the time. I thought it was funny. She didn't. She was crying. My mom sent me in the house. Middle of summer. During the week, there's nothing on at night, so I turned the TV on, and I turned the stations to a UHF station in Milwaukee, and All-Star Wrestling is on. And I remember the first couple guys that I saw were Mad Dog Vachon and Killer Kowalski. Mad Dog Vachon was probably the most ruthless wrestler in the ring. I actually had nightmares from watching them, and I thought at the time, like, what mother would name their child Mad Dog and have that name? But a number of years down the road, I used to go to the matches all the time at the Milwaukee Auditorium and Arena, and my inspirations to getting into the business were Bobby Heenan and Ray Stevens, two of probably the greatest heel wrestlers ever. Just the way that they would respond to the babyface, which is the good guy, they were the heels or the villains, and how the crowd reacted when they retreated, and it was called selling for the good guys. and it just the crowd just, you know, rose in enthusiasm when they would, when the good guys would get the better of them. And I thought, you know what, this is what I want to do. And that's what I did.
Wow. Chris Muldrow wrestled professionally for more than two decades, starting in 1978. You may know him as Chris Curtis. The Milwaukee wrestler is taking us through his career. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about professional wrestling? Do you love it? Did you go in person sometime? You're part of this conversation. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Chris, let's fast forward to when you're in the ring. You were something called a job man. Tell me about your role in these wrestling events.
Well, a job man is the term for somebody like me and a number of other wrestlers, hundreds of them, that we were paid to take a fall for the mid-card wrestlers and the stars, and we made them look good. 20 or 30 years ago, I would not be on a program like this exposing the business, but the cat's been out of the bag for years now. But it was our job to make them look really strong, because in order for the promoter in the territory to draw money, he needed either a real strong heel, let's say the Crusher, against somebody like Nick Bockwinkel. So it was our job to make their big moves, their finishing moves, look really strong so that people would see them.
Yeah.
And in turn, if we did a really good job, it would make us look good, and the office would use us more for house shows, or we call them arena matches, that kind of thing. And they would use us more on TV because we wanted to make it look as believable as possible, that, you know, the crowd would, we in professional wrestling, you had to keep the audience guessing. You wanted to make them think, is, you know, people thought, you know, they had opinions. Is it real? Is it fake? Is it, they're not quite sure. It was our job to make it look like it was real. And
yeah,
really had him guessing.
And you say in your book that professional wrestlers are athletes, and but you also talk about the fact that they're entertainers and that they're storytellers. I mean, the story was crucial to the audience response when you got in the ring, right?
It was. There was a it was a storyline, and that's how you could bring people in week after week. There are some, back in the old territories, some territories ran on a weekly basis, every 2 weeks, the towns. And you had to have a strong storyline that would carry on week after week or month after month to draw those people in. And that's what we did. That's how you, the bottom line in professional wrestling, Keely, is making money and drawing the people in there. And the fans, the better job you did, sometimes they got overzealous, and you know, you just had to be careful. But that's okay. We knew it was all part of that. If the fans didn't boo me, call me names, used gestures, that kind of thing, threatened me, I didn't do my job. You know, I thought about this in the past too. It's like, why would we want to get into a business where the people wanted to really hurt you?
Thank you for asking my question. Why? That's a lot.
Well, because we want to perform. In order to get into professional wrestling, especially being a heel, and I was a heel, I was the villain, you had to kind of be marching to a different drum, so to speak. You had to have the psyche of like, you know what, we're kind of crazy a little bit. And you were getting into business like this. I remember my mom telling me when I wanted to go to leave Milwaukee and go down south and wrestle full time. She told my dad, she said, we send him to school for Catholic school for 12 years and he wants to be a wrestler. I mean, it's because that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And we have a whole different personality.
Did your mom ever come around?
Yes and no. I had a match one time in Milwaukee, and I was going up the street with a couple of friends of mine. One of them was my coworker. My mom was running down the street with my brother, one of my brothers, and his best friend, and she had my wrestling bag, and she said, Wally Carbo called, who was the promoter. He was co-owner of the AWA with Vern Gagne. You have to wrestle tonight. And so I got him in the building, and I've had bad knees since I was 13 years old. And the guy I was wrestling was Adrian Adonis. Adrian had me in a spinning toe hold and a leg lock. And she got up and was screaming at the top of her lungs that I have bad knees. So
Mom was trying to help you out there.
She was. And the thing was I was really milking it. And because Adrian asked me, he bent over and he said, "Who is that?" And I go, "That's my mom." And he said, "You're kidding." And I said, "No." And I said, "Crank it up even more." And I really laid it on. I could have got the Academy Award that night.
You know what? It's all about the theater, Chris. There's so much more that we could explore when it comes to your wrestling career. We have to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing these insights today.
I appreciate it, and thank you for having me on.
Certainly. Chris Molterer wrestled professionally for more than two decades, starting in 1978. You may know him as the heel Chris Curtis. And his book out is called Job Man, My Life in Professional Wrestling. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a listener question about the woods in northern Wisconsin.
When someone lives to be 100 years old, people tend to ask them about the secrets to their longevity. Trees, on the other hand, live to be hundreds and hundreds of years. How do they survive? WXPR's Mackenzie Martin recently headed to an old-growth forest to learn more. It's part of their Curious North series.
We've been getting a lot of Curious North questions about trees this year, like this one from Coyote Heron in Three Lakes.
Are there any old-growth sections or oldest trees in the area that are secreted away that general public doesn't know about?
When this question came in, I immediately thought of John Bates in Mercer. In addition to being a naturalist, he's the author of Our Living Ancestors, The History and Ecology of Old Growth Forests in Wisconsin and Where to Find Them, which he self-published last year.
So how's it going?
We recently met up at the Germaine Hemlock State Natural Area in Harshaw. Bates lists this site in his book as one of the 50 best old growth sites in Wisconsin. Other favorites of his in Oneida County are the Enterprise Hemlocks, Hombo Conifer Forest, and the Kemp Woods.
Alrighty, so we're seeing some big trees. So this is a forest that is dominated particularly by eastern hemlock.
As to where you can find some of the oldest trees, limited sampling has been done on the sections in Wisconsin, but growing out of the sides of cliffs on the Niagara Escarpment are bonsai-like white cedars that are sometimes well over 1,000 years old and just an inch in diameter. Bates' book is partially a map to the best old growth in the state. A lot of the sites he lists are state natural areas, but others he tracked down in other ways, sometimes following up on tips people sent him, though those often ended as dead ends, in part because there's a sliding scale on what old growth forest really is.
Because how old does a tree have to be considered old growth? A white pine can live 400 years, but we consider white pine old growth 120 to 150 years old. That's barely middle age. On the other hand, we have species that are sun lovers and short-lived species, like our aspens, popple trees, same thing. They usually only live to be 80, maybe 100 years old. So if you have an 80-year-old aspen, that's really old growth.
Old growth forests require a thriving ecosystem, and the percentage of them in Wisconsin is actually pretty small, just 0.2% of Wisconsin forests, meaning 99.8% of them have been cut, and none of the sites left are very large.
I have not been able to find in the 15 years that I spent researching this book and wandering all around the state, I couldn't find one square mile of true remnant old growth forest left in the entire state. We were that thorough in our cutting of these old forests.
Bates really stresses the importance of death for a healthy forest. Take a hemlock, for example. It takes roughly 200 years for a hemlock to decompose.
And in the process of decomposing, they get covered with moss. And that moss provides this super nice, moist base for little tiny seeds to get started. Here are hemlock cones. If they fall on a log that's covered in moss, they can survive the dry weather. And so in these old-growth forests, what you do is you look for straight lines of trees, and you'll see them frequently, where the trees all got started on some big grandmother tree that fell over, got covered in moss, seeds all fell on that, what's called now, a nurse log. It nursed these seeds along.
You also end up with trees with exposed roots because the log they got started on decomposed beneath them.
Here's a new young hemlock. Here's a hemlock. Here's another young hemlock. All this life comes out of that one or two deaths.
Bates says this. This is partly why he spent 15 years researching old-growth forests, to help people better understand them, with the hope of instilling a deeper respect for them.
I always laugh that if we could have people lay down in the woods in a nice wind and just listen to that hum that goes through those trees and watch those trees sway, that the peace that would be encountered would put a lot of psychiatrists out of work.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin Project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. Now, Republicans are pressing for the release of the name of the whistleblower who sparked the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. During yesterday's first public hearings in the House Intelligence Committee, Republican U.S. Congressman Jim Jordan had this exchange with Democratic Chair U.S. Congressman Adam Schiff.
Just to ask a clarifying question, do you anticipate when we might vote on the ability to have the whistleblower in front of us, something you... Of the 435 members of Congress, you are the only member who knows who that individual is, and your staff is the only staff of any member of Congress who's had a chance to talk with that individual. We would like that opportunity. When might that happen in this proceeding today?
First, as the gentleman knows, that's a false statement. I do not know the identity of the whistleblower, and I'm determined to make sure that identity is protected. But as I said to Mr. Conaway, you will have an opportunity, after the witnesses testify, to make a motion to subpoena any witness and compel a vote.
Some conservative news outlets have named an alleged whistleblower. Wisconsin Public Radio is following NPR's guidance, and we are not naming the individual. But what, if anything, is stopping Republicans, including President Trump, from outing the whistleblower? And what kind of protections are in place to protect someone who blows the whistle? This is a conversation that involves you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're wondering, where have you seen whistleblowers really make meaningful strides for democracy? Have you seen wrongdoing where you work? How did you respond? Did you consider yourself a whistleblower? And what place do you see whistleblowers having in democracy? Is it a political move? Are there motivations at play? Or is this really an apolitical act? You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We're having this conversation about what it means to be a whistleblower and what's fair. Once you are a whistleblower, does that mean you are entitled to protections? Or does it mean that it's a free-for-all, that you've spoken up and now people are allowed and able to know your name? 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Bultina. We're having a conversation about whether Republicans can legally out the whistleblower who triggered the Trump impeachment inquiry. And Dan Meyer is our guest. He's blown the whistle three times, used to lead the program that the whistleblower in the Trump-Ukraine call used to file their complaint. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, glad to be here.
Help us understand. We seem to have different versions of what it means to be a whistleblower. What is it exactly?
So a whistleblower is somebody who lawfully discloses wrongdoing to somebody who can fix the problem. So the confusion often comes when people think of the 1970s model of whistleblowers going to like the New York Times during the Nixon administration. Non-intel federal employees can go to the media, but the theory is simply that when they go to the media, they're informing Congress and Congress can then fix the problem. For people like this whistleblower, they cannot go to the media. And so a whistleblower tightly defined would be somebody who goes to, for instance, an inspector general or goes through an inspector general to Congress, to the House or Senate Intelligence Committee staff. So it's the whistleblower is somebody who's actually not public. It's somebody who goes through official channels, and that's done to control classified information so that we don't inadvertently leak classified information.
So if you're a whistleblower, are you guaranteed anonymity?
No, absolutely not. So this is a big misconception. Now, as a matter of policy, many inspectors general or heads of agencies will want to have anonymity for whistleblower, but it's just a policy option. The actual protections under the law, the inspector general himself cannot reveal the whistleblower's identity unless it's required in the course of an investigation, so it's qualified anonymity. And then there is no binding law on a member of Congress divulging the name of the whistleblower. It would be a policy decision not to do that, unless it's a rule of the committee in question. So unless the congressman is on like the House Intelligence or the Senate Intelligence Committee, which do have rules about divulging confidentiality of sources, but the congressman is not on those committees, then he or she could conceivably reveal the name of the whistleblower and not have a penalty.
Yeah. How important is it generally to know who's blowing the whistle? How much does that matter?
So as a federal investigator, I used to run these investigations for about 14 years. You receive a lot of information. Some of it comes anonymously. Some of it comes from sources that are identified. So if you have an unidentified source, you need to corroborate that. You need to find independent basis for those facts. And if the person doesn't want to have their name ascribed to the information, they don't want to be in the report or they don't want to show up at a hearing, you have to understand that, okay, you've received the information, but you have to find it somewhere else and often in a couple of other places because every fact you want to corroborate by two or three sources. So if you have anonymity, if you want to protect a source, if you want to bury a source is what the term we use in the federal investigative field, then you have to go find that information independently from somebody else. And then you could include it in your report. So it's not necessary to have the whistleblower's identity known because in this particular instance in Washington right now, there's been corroboration through other sources. In fact, you're probably soon going to get even more accurate information than the whistleblower had through sources that'll be in open hearings and testify with the individual out in the open.
Let's bring Nate in Milwaukee into this conversation. Nate, what's your take here?
Hi. I hope that they do not release the whistleblower's name. I compare this to when somebody calls 911 and the police arrive, are supposed to check things out and see if it matches what the person said. And not only that, one of the protections we have against corruption is people who are trying to blow the whistle. So not only can the whistleblower potentially lose his job if Trump finds him, but it's hurts our ability to defend ourselves against corruption if we allow whistleblowers to be harmed.
Nate, thanks for that comment. Dan, is that concept one of the tenets? I mean, you were the executive director for intelligence community whistleblowing and source protection. Was that a value that you held when doing these investigations?
Oh, absolutely. And Nate's got a great point. There's a real good Milwaukee sense there. The idea is to hoover in as much information as possible through your hotlines, through your intake process. And then as an investigator, you sift through. You want to bias the system to creating as much disclosure as possible. And one of the ways you create that bias is you allow people to be anonymous when they bring information into, for instance, an inspector general. We were so scrupulous about this when I worked for the inspector general at the time, Irvin Charles McCullough III. Chuck would allow me to redact disclosures that went to the Director of National Intelligence before they went to the committees on the Hill. So just like this whistleblower, it went to Inspector General Atkinson and then to the acting Director of National Intelligence, Joe McGuire. Then it went up to the Hill. In our case, it went into my boss, Chuck McCullough, and then Jim Clapper, the DNI at the time, would receive it. And Chuck would allow me actually to redact the disclosures and take the names out of the individuals when it went to the DNI. And I would call the DNI staff ahead of time and say, look, I'm not trying to insult you by removing the source's name, but on this particular issue, there might be people on your floor over at the headquarters that I don't want them to see the name of the whistleblower. So we're just going to button it up and send it up to the Hill. And Director Clapper was brilliant on this. I mean, he understood the policy and the need to protect sources. So he would say, fine, Dan, that's not a problem. Just thank the whistleblower for being a patriotic American.
Dan Meyer is a lawyer in Washington, D.C., a three-time whistleblower, also used to oversee the program that the whistleblower on Trump's Ukraine call used to file their complaint. And let's go ahead and bring Helen in the Madison area into the conversation now. Helen, what's your take here?
Okay. Well, you have people that say have a conversation. My question for everyone is, have you ever had a conversation where one person took it one way and another person took it another way and was offended by it? It happens every day. So when I've been watching this Congress thing for the last couple of days, and all they're talking about is feelings and what he thinks, nobody can tell what anybody thinks or how they feel. Some people come off obtuse. Some people come off cold. Some people come off warm and friendly. No one can read what anybody's thinking.
Sure. And Helen, Helen's talking about really focusing on interpretation and not the facts. How critical, Dan, are facts to a whistleblower complaint?
Well, I would recruit Helen to be a federal investigator. That's exactly the sort of skepticism you bring into an investigation. We would frequently ask a witness, do you believe that or do you know it? You know, is this a fact in your head or is it something you perceived? So the critical question here is, and in this matter that's unfolding in Washington right now, I don't think there's a lot of difference on the facts themselves. I think even the president has conceded some of the facts. I think it is a lot about interpretation. And so the jurors, if this goes to the Senate for trial, the senators who are sitting in judgment of the president will have to sift through exactly that analysis that Helen has presented, and they'll have to decide these facts as they're presented. Is this simply diplomacy, sort of bare-knuckled diplomacy, or is this bribery? Those would be the two extremes. And the difference between those interpretations on the same facts is getting to the core of what was going on inside the White House. And that's why people with direct knowledge of those communications is very important. The word hearsay is getting very difficult in this process because this is not a court and hearsay doesn't really apply. What people need to focus on is the evidence direct? The person who's presenting the evidence see it, smell it, taste it, hear it themselves, or is it indirect? Did it come through another party? You can have a lot of indirect evidence and move forward with a finding based on that indirect evidence, but you have to have a lot of people bringing you indirect evidence that all lines up and shows a certain interpretation of the facts. You can have less direct evidence, and that direct evidence will prove very quickly for you that there was a problem or there was not a problem. So it's a balancing between the two. That's what federal investigators do all the time. So Helen's got a great point.
Steve from Sun Prairie wants to join our conversation about protections for whistleblowers. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is, or a comment really too, is I believe strongly in the whistle protection law. It makes sense. The problem is the investigation should be done in secret. So things should not be leaked out while the investigation is going on. It reminds me so much of the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin, where the people that were being talked about had to be quiet, but yet people were leaking information out. So how do you balance that out?
Steve, thanks for that question. Yeah, the balance between what the public needs and deserves to know and, doing things confidentially. What do you think, Dan?
Tight discipline is what you need. And if you want an example of an investigation where that was not the case, some of my colleagues back at the Office of the Inspector General for the Defense Department were involved in the investigation of whether Pat Tillman, the NFL quarterback who was serving in Afghanistan, was killed or whether it was friendly fire. And there were some leaks in that investigation that were very unhelpful for the team trying to wrap it up and come to a coherent and solid set of findings based on the facts. So, yes, no, you need to have deep discipline on that team. Chairman Schiff's team is pretty disciplined in that regard. There have been leaks, I agree. There's been leaks on both sides, and that's part of the nature of the Congress. It is a leaky organization, and it always gave us great trepidation inside the intelligence community to send our sources up there because we realized that it is the people's house, and it tends to run in a very open and transparent way, and it's very difficult to discipline it. But yes, no, in the best of all circumstances, you button it up, you complete the investigation, and then you move to the more public aspects where the product of the investigation is briefed not only to the other members of Congress and eventually to the jurors in the Senate, but also to the American people. Because remember, in the end, the American people are sovereign in this entire arrangement. We have no king, we have no queen in America. We the people in Congress assembled are the sovereign. And in the end, those senators, when they vote on the president, will be voting based on their perception of what the folks at home are thinking about this whole issue. Which is why, in the end, once you get all the facts all rolled up and you have your findings, it's going to be polls and local polls that determine actually how those senators vote.
All right. Certainly, this is an evolving conversation, and we'll be back to it many times. Dan, thank you so much for your time with us.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Dan Meyer is a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and a three-time whistleblower. And we've been talking about the whistleblower's identity and whether it should be released in the Trump impeachment inquiry. This conversation continues online at Central Time at WPR.org, or you can tweet at Central Time WPR. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, media outlets argue it's the public's right to know about criminal charges. And some arrest voters are even open to the public. Our guest examines the effects of crime coverage. We weigh the potential risks of not reporting the information with the importance of accuracy and fairness. All that and more, explore it with us tomorrow on Central Time from 3 o'clock until 7.